Ladies and gentlemen, today is the first day of the rest of your life. And now, listen in as Kristen and Johnny bring it all to the table on the Vision Board Podcast.
Guys, welcome back. Episode 175 of the Vision Board Podcast. I'm Tristan Cannell, and alongside me, Johnny Stufko.
What's up, everyone? What's up, Tristan? 175. What's going on?
Yeah, man. Special guest today is Derek Hansen.
Yeah, Derek is a guy, you know, he's been brought up in recent interviews over the last year and a half. I know a couple mutual friends are speed coaches and strength coaches, and he's working side by side with pro athletes, Olympians, and, you know, his work, research, all that good stuff. We're stoked to get him on.
Yeah, he's trusted by the likes of, like, Buddy Morris, someone that I really, you know, highly rate within this industry. And some of his work with all the professional athletes, obviously sprint and track and field, his number one go-to. It's his specific niche, but it's been interesting. Like, it is a very interesting subject, sprinting and speed and that sort of stuff.
In my opinion, it goes in the realm of human potential, seeing what you can get out of a human, how much juice is in that body sort of thing. Like, if you squeeze an orange, what's going to come out? And when you specialize as a performance coach with that speed, I think I start to get interested. Some guys are really into the heavy weightlifters. Some guys are really into maybe the movement. I like the speed sort of thing because you could see it. And playing sports like yourself, you kind of could equate that guy got speed. That's a different thing.
The need for speed is huge. When you see Usain Bolt,
yeah,
it blows you away how much he's just a freak of nature to run that fast. You see a boxer who's got faster hands, you take more notice of the guy. For me, just from my own perspective, I take it a far greater interest in someone that's faster for some reason. Yeah. It just blows me away how quick they are in the ring.
And yeah, it's just me too, man. And it's like, if we could get a guy that could talk about the, you know, implementing processes to help increase that speed, like Derek is going to outline bits of this interview, or his opinions also, you know, being coming from a sporting background, it was always an excuse in my group of friends, partially for me, because I was always a truck. I hung out with guys way faster than me. It was always, oh, it's a genetic thing. They were born with it. So the older we get, we start realizing that part of that is true, but then also understanding the movements of the body and knowing how to run and knowing the mechanics of running, and then also the training aspect of what to do to get you at your most potential, that's why these chats like this are important.
Yeah, for sure.
To highlight those sort of, you know, reasons, and just to get people a broader understanding of something as simple as a guy running, but there's a bunch of science behind that.
All right, guys, before we get Derek on the show, just a big shout out to everyone tuning in that have subscribed for free via iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher. Please, guys, if you haven't yet, please log on and please leave us a 5-star review. It really helps us just reach more people and grow, and we can just, you know, spread the message of guys like Derek and all the great guests that we've had on.
Couldn't said it better, guys. Get on there, support the cause, tell your friends, tag your friends, share it, hit us up.
Definitely. All right, guys, let's get straight to it. I'm really, really glad to bring this one to you. And I introduce Derek Hansen. All right, guys, our special guest is Derek Hansen. Derek is a strength and conditioning specialist who has been working with athletes in speed and strength and power since 1988. He originally was working with track and field athletes, but has since also worked with top performers as a coach and consultant across a number of Olympic and professional sports. We welcome Derek Hansen. Derek, welcome.
Thank you, fellas. Thank you for having me. And like I said, I've been watching what you guys are doing, and it just, it's good content, but it's just the way you guys deliver. It's really cool, and I think that's huge, right? That's a huge part of it. If you're not capturing my interest, then, you know, there's other things that may, right?
Yeah.
So I think you guys are really good at that. So that's why I'm happy to be involved with you guys.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, thanks, Derek. We really appreciate that. Like Tristan aforementioned, I wanted to open up the whole, specializing in speed specifically. Off air, I was talking to Tristan about my own personal interest in it, whether it's like I'm interested in the human potential side. Like when you look at speed and the movement of the athlete, it's like, yeah, you could track the number of how fast they go. But what we're also doing is seeing that human perform at the highest level. You talk about sprinters. What got you into that specific realm initially? You know, since 1988, you've been in that specific area.
Yeah, like I was a track athlete all my life. I played other sports, and, you know, I started at the age of, like, you know, getting serious, like, pretty early, like 11, 12 years old, did all the events, sprinted. And I, you know, growing up, I was typically one of the faster people in my school and then in my high school. And you're like, oh, okay, this is pretty cool. And it transferred well to other sports. So if I played soccer, hey, it was pretty useful. They're like, hey, you're fast. If I played basketball, football, whatever. Yeah. So right then you kind of go, okay, this is a really good quality to have. And then when I went into university, I competed at collegiate track and field, mostly in sprints and jumps, like long jump, triple jump. And then, you know, in 88, like, they said, oh, we want you to come coach some kids. So at a very, very early age, I was coaching young kids and taking what I had done and going, okay, well, I got to coach some kids. And, you know, maybe they're not, maybe they listened to me, maybe they didn't. But it was just, it started getting me involved in the coaching side really early. And, you know, I think a lot of the things that we do are governed by trial and error. Mm-hmm. And so the larger my sample size, you know, I started early, the more I could kind of see, okay, that's interesting, that worked, that didn't work. And I think that's the big thing. Everybody wants to talk about, you know, what book should I read, and, you know, who should I go see talk. And that's great, but you got to get out there. Like you guys talked about, get out there and do it. And you're going to fail a bit, but a lot of the time you're going to get value out of both the failures and the successes, right? So I think that was the thing for me. I started coaching kids. I saw what made them faster. I saw what made me faster. You kind of put two and two together. And then when I was finished my career, it was kind of an easy transition to become a coach. And just, you know, it was actually more enjoyable on some level because you get to help more people. And it's not just about you. So, that's really how it started. I was a track and field athlete, started coaching track and field, and then you start working with other athletes because they see the value in it as well. So I was talking to some guys the other day, and we're watching an NFL game. And, you know, some people like to just talk about strength or endurance or this or that. And you know, I find it very hard sometimes to get people to work on sprinting speed, whatever their sport. In most sports, you got to run, right? It's a huge part of it. It's what separates everybody out is how fast you can run. But it's very hard to get people to train that, even at the highest level. Like at the NFL, like it's very hard. That's what I do all my talks when I speak to the NFL people, rehab, strength and conditioning. Like, how much do you guys sprint? And it's not much.
Really?
So right then and there, you find out, okay, you know, and then we're watching this NFL game, and Chris Collinsworth is like, wow, that guy is really fast. Look at him separated. That's a, you know, if you were that fast, you could really, you know, make a big impression in this league. And I'm like, look, this guy's even saying it. So,
yeah.
You know, what you hear and what people say and then trying to get them to do it is very difficult. And I don't know why. I don't know why people don't want to sprint, or maybe, you know, there's some of it is, well, maybe I'll get hurt. But it's just the hardest thing to get organizations to really do, even though we all know it's valuable. So that's kind of where I'm at with it.
Yes, Derek, speed really intrigues me, the fact that, you know, from your own time researching and just from your own personal experience, in terms of genetics, like, for example, you've got someone like, you say, when Marion Jones was married to Tim Montgomery and they had a child, is that child automatically going to be fast? And then you got, like, for my own family, I'm fast and my brother's not. Like, how much does genetics play into determining whether someone will be fast or not?
I think it's a huge part, and I wrote an article a little while ago just about this idea of natural selection being a pretty good way to govern how, you know, who comes out on top.
Yeah.
You know, you have people with we all have our own genetics, and then you impose stress, you put people into competition, and usually the people that are better will rise to the top. So, you know, part of that is genetics, and it was interesting. I was at it was a camp for kids, but it was NFL players that attended and were giving the camp.
Yep.
And one of the players was with the Giants, Odell Beckham, right?
So he's super fast.
And so they had a little thing where the parents got to ask, the kids got to ask the players, like, questions. And so all the parents is like, I'm going to ask a question about how hard he worked, you know, how many days a week did you train, and how many hours. And so all those questions were going up, and I'm looking at these parents, and I'm going, man, you just don't have the genetics. I don't care how hard your kid trains. You are not going to be one of these guys, right? Yeah. And that's part of it. That's a huge part of it. Obviously, the environment is important and making sure you develop that talent. But, yeah, I mean, there's variability within, you know, families. And I know some people who are, like, really fast and some people not so fast. So there's other factors, I guess, in terms of – and I'm not a geneticist, but in terms of, like, you know, leg length, where the tendons attach, all these other things, you know, not just fiber type. I think I always tell people, like, when you're coaching, and Charlie Francis said this a lot, have as large a pool as possible, because you don't know. Like, the people that I know that were fast when I was in grade, you know, 5 or 6, weren't necessarily the people who were fast when I was in grade 10 or 11, right? And then even beyond it. So you don't really know. And the more that you start to over-specialize early and you say, like, you're going to be this, the more you're going to be, you know, disappointed when it comes out to, like, you know, who's going to the Olympics or who's going to be on the pro team, because you just don't know. And I think that's the real problem right now, is we want to put everybody into a lane and say, that's what you're going to do at a very early age. But I think we're missing out.
From a speed performance perspective, I want to talk about some lessons. I'm going to use Jerry Rice. He was one of my favorite athletes. He was, you know, Super Bowl champion receiver for the Niners. And during his career, analysts, it was almost like they needed to find a hole in his game. And they would talk about Rice's 40 time wasn't as fast as the others, and he wasn't that quick straight. But the guy would always get open, and what we found, his angles and his technique, he would always outrun guys. And then you'd have a guy like Randy Moss. His 40 time, I think he was like a 4.3 coming out of
he's tall too,
right? A Marshall. Yeah, that speed in relation to, you know, on the American, you know, football field, going linear straight versus like the angle changes. Talk about the difference of that sort of speed compared to just a sprinter.
Yeah, I mean, it would be nice if you could say that, you know, we just put people on a line in the 100 meters and we just say, okay, you're going to be a receiver. But obviously, like you said, there's other aspects of running that pattern, and if you could catch. And I was actually, it's funny you should say, I was watching film of Jerry Rice, like, just the other night. I'm like, oh, you know why? Because this may not go over well with people, but one of the most amazing runners, I thought, in the NFL, in the history of the NFL, was O.J. Simpson. Like, if you watch him run, yeah, like, this dude could, like, cut, turn, whatever, and then he could be a world-class sprinter, right?
Yeah.
And his hip position and his front side mechanics were really good. And so, on YouTube, you're watching YouTube, and then the next one comes up, it was Jerry Rice. And then there's certain qualities of Jerry Rice that I saw that were similar to O.J. in terms of when he got to top speed, in terms of his mechanics. And so you watch how he ran when he got upright, and he was really good. So maybe that 40-yard dash time was biased against him, because maybe he wasn't as good in the first, like, 10 or 20. And you know, he was very good running a slant, getting the ball, like, 5 or 10 yards down, and then he went out and took off. So, you know, maybe that's not a good test to really determine, you know, is somebody going to be successful on the football field, right?
Yeah, because millions are on the line. Like, our Australian fans listening, if they're not familiar, the NFL Combine, you get these guys right out of college, 19, 20, 21 years old, maybe 22. During the Combine, one of the main – maybe it's changed. I've been in Australia for 4 years, so correct me if I'm wrong. But, you know, I played American football my whole life, and I know that if you could get that 40 time under, like, 4.3, you're going to get signed. And that's a huge thing. Fractions of a second create millionaires. So – maybe share insights on our guys hiring coaches specifically for that one sprint. Have you seen any kind of examples of that, not even looking at the bigger picture?
I mean, I think that's always, there's always going to be a couple of teams that are going to go for that, right? Like, this guy may have very average film, and then, boom, he does that at the combine. And there's a lot of insecurity in professional sports, so somebody's like, well, shit, maybe we better grab him because he might turn out to be, you know, special, right?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, everybody I talk to who I trust, they're like, you know, we look at those combine tests, but really it's the game film that we're looking at and going, okay, what is this guy's tendencies in a game situation? You know, okay, maybe if the guy ran a 5.2, you know, we're like, wait a minute, like, okay, okay, that's a red flag. Maybe it tells us that he doesn't train properly or he's not focused. But if they like the guy on film and, you know, he runs a 4.55, I mean, they're probably going to still go with him. So I think that, you know, for the most part, the combine is kind of just an extra check to figure out, okay, is this the guy we really want? You know, is he in the ballpark speed-wise? Everybody I talk to says the most important part of the combine is the interviews, background checks, and the medicals, right? Because you don't want to pick a guy that could be injury prone or has just a disastrous history. Like, that was the funny thing. When I was at combine in 2015, the medical, it was almost kind of sickening because you're like in there and they're just bringing these guys in, throw them on a table, all the MRIs and x-rays go on the wall, and the doctors like swarm on the guy and are like, you know, testing this joint and this joint. You're like, geez, this is like a meat market, right? So, you know, they're obviously very concerned about those types of things if the guy has good character and all that. But there's always going to be somebody taking a chance on a flyer where they're like, oh, we didn't know that guy could do that. You know, but it's a very, that's one sample of an ability at a given time. And if you're going to put all your chips on that, I think it might not work out for you. So, I don't know. The combine is an interesting, I think the combine now has become almost like a bit of a sideshow, like it's an event
yeah.
itself. Whether it's an important selection event, I don't know,
yeah.
you know, but it's certainly interesting.
Yeah, Derek, just thinking on the combine and the NFL, are you surprised how fast some of these guys can actually run with the amount of extra muscle mass and just weight that these guys carry?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you were to line them up and do the same thing over 100 meters, I think you'd obviously see a really big fall off after about 40 yards.
Yeah, okay.
And you know, we watch Usain Bolt run and all these other guys run, and everybody's pretty tight to that distance. Like, I think it's about 36 meters, right? So you're at 36 meters, pretty even. And then people start to separate out. So
is that a stamina thing? Is that endurance, conditioning?
No, what it is it's the ability to keep accelerating, right? Okay. So because of that muscle mass, you know, at the further you go into the acceleration, the more sort of flexibility you have to have, and obviously weight's an issue, and just, you know, just your elastic ability. And I think football players probably have more strength than power, and so they can get away with that early acceleration and still look pretty good and get a good time.
Yep.
But as they get to higher speeds, now that weight becomes a detriment, and now they're tighter and they can't really open up. And their ground contact time just isn't, they can't keep shortening it because they don't have the elasticity.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, yes, to, you know, like you've always heard the stories like Olympic weightlifters can sprint like 10 meters or 20 meters just like a world-class sprinters, which may be true because it's mostly muscular strength and power. It's not, the elasticity starts to come in as you go further down the track, and I think that's what really separates people out is that elastic ability.
Yeah. What about some
so, of technique?
Derek, you saying Bolt, you were talking about accelerating. And, like, have you studied him much? Like, how far does he accelerate until he actually starts slowing down?
Typical top speed is going to be attained around 60 meters or 6 seconds. Like, it really coincides with, like, the energy systems, right?
Yeah.
So that initial energy system, short-term energy system, is going to deplete around 6 or 7 seconds. So, you know, the acceleration curve will peak about 60 meters, and then you see everybody starts to drop off. He's tended to hit top speed further granted, so maybe 70, so he can still accelerate a little farther. And then when he gets to top speed, one, he's falling from a higher point. So even if this guy's going, you know, keeps accelerating, he's falling from a higher point, he's still going faster. The other part is he doesn't decelerate that much. In that Beijing race, the only reason he decelerated is because he's like doing this, like waving to the crowd and stuff like that. But you know, you know, he was pretty amazing, and perhaps he could have ran faster if, you know, he did focus on just running right through the tape in a couple of those races. But, yeah, he's accelerated, and I think his levers, the lever length has made it easier for him to maybe accelerate a little farther. He has that combination of strength, elasticity, and the length of the levers to take him a little farther than the average sprinter. So he had a lot of things going for him, and, you know, he was hitting the highest top speed of anyone. So,
as a kid playing sports in Northeast Ohio, there were, speed was always like a myth. And I was kind of messing around, almost like a half-hearted idea for this interview, to do like a Mythbusters, just random questions to you and hearing your opinion on it. But I'm going to ask one of them that I wrote down. So like whenever there'd be a guy that just was super fast, our buddy's going up with like, man, he's fast because he has an extra muscle in the leg or the extra, he's built differently. Have you one heard of that? This is an excuse I call it for guys who aren't as fast as the dude that they're talking about. And two, maybe share what that is, you know, these myths for excuses for making guys have extra muscles. Have you heard that before?
I have not. That's a new one for me. I don't know where that muscle would go. Did they give you an indicator, was it a hamstring, was it a calf?
So my buddy, if hopefully he's listening, Albert Sly, he was one of the best Little League ball players I ever played with. And the boys would say Albert's faster than everyone because he had an extra calf muscle in the calf. Extra muscle in the calf because he was a black, African-American. Did you ever hear any of these? I had to ask you.
No.
My boy wanted me. He's like, Johnny, you have to ask Derek that one. So have you ever heard that one?
No, I haven't heard that one, but I'm not sure.
Was it something that you could actually see? Like somebody looked at his calf like,
No, bro science, for sure. There used to be, before Google and the internet, there was a lot more bro science because we weren't able to, like, investigate and research if your buddies were kind of BSing. So it was kind of like the Kentucky Fried Mouse sort of thing, a friend of a friend.
Actually, I've got one for both of you. When you were growing up in Australia, people used to make up time. So, for example, they say, oh, I can run 100 meters in 11 flat. And I know for a fact that I'm faster than you and I can't do 12.
Yeah.
So it's like... Did you guys used to have that a lot?
Dude, speed is always like
just the makeup time to make you feel
fast. Like I ran a 4.2 and like, okay, well, what evidence do you have? Well, I had my sister timing me and okay, what kind of watch did she use? She did like one Mississippi, two Mississippi. Like, so yeah, there's all sorts of excuses and if there's almost like an equivalent. So if you actually ran a 4.9, somehow you got 3 extra tenths of a second, so like it was a 4.6 or like a 4.59. So yeah, it's the only way that you can accurate. And that's the thing, like the combine timing
Are they using a laser? Or are they still using a click?
They're still using like a hand start, and I think sometimes it might be an electronic finish. But even then, I still think there's somebody up top like that's going. That's a 4.5, right? Because they've taken video and they've superimposed two guys who ran the same time, and then one guy gets out ahead. You're like, wait a minute, that's, you know, there's something fishy. So what I think has happened is if you want to get an accurate time, then you're going to have to pull that off of video or something and do it like they do at the Olympics, so that, you know, on first the gun or whatever first movement, it's actually accurate. And then what will happen is that 4.4 will now become a 4.6. And then that, you know, so everybody will run slower based on accurate timing. And I don't think they want to go there because then now it's like apples and oranges, right? Like, oh, this is the new, these are the non-steroid world records versus the steroid world records, right? So, you know, I just think, whatever. And maybe that's a good, that speaks to this idea that maybe it doesn't matter that much, right? So, you know, to the GMs or the talent ID guys in the NFL, I don't know, but it's very interesting.
What interests you more, an athlete or an athlete that you've seen evolve, that you've seen grow and get faster and stronger, who is now a hell of a sprinter, versus a kid that was just born with it? From a coaching perspective, do you have one favorite, like the natural guy who just comes in like with the instincts, or the one that developed it and gets to that next level?
I mean, I kind of have respect for both because I think a lot of people have kind of, you know, poo-pooed these guys who just have talent and, you know, oh, this guy didn't work hard. But a lot of time to make people fast, it's not about, like, running thousands and thousands of meters of speed. It's about finding the right amount for them. And usually it's going to be less than you think. So maybe some of these guys who do less, maybe they're just, you know, it's kind of auto-regulating and going, okay, I feel like I've done enough. So it's difficult. Like, I understand what you're saying. Like, I love the guys who put in the time and are kind of students of the sport and study, like, their mechanics and all that. And then you have one guy just show up, and you're like, oh, my God, that guy just has it all naturally. Like, I have a video. I'll send it to you guys.
For sure.
I have a video of, like, 8-year-olds or 9-year-olds running at a track meet. And so right then, it kind of became clear to me that the people who have the natural ability or better technique are going to finish first. But they have better technique because they have the elasticity and things just kind of, you know, they become front side more easily because they have that elasticity when they hit the ground. And then the kid that has no elasticity, he's the one who reaches out in front, pushes way out back, and he's like flopping along. And so in this video, you see this clearly because none of them have like world-class coaches. You know, it's like some teacher who, you know, barely knows physical education, and they just put them in the race. So that is pure natural selection, watching these guys run. And the guy who's first just has the physical abilities that make his technique look better, and then the guy who's last looks horrible. And that video right there just made me think more about, okay, so what is my job? Is it to tell this guy to run better, or is it to give him the physical qualities so that he can run better? And so working on elasticity, I think, is very important. And maybe people aren't doing plyos as much. So, you know, I'm a big fan of the weight room. Mm-hmm. And I'm never going to say don't lift weights, but I cannot honestly say that lifting weights is going to make somebody faster. It may give them some qualities that allow you to train them to be faster, but if all you do is lift weights, you know, there's that great video on YouTube where it shows the bodybuilder running a 40-yard dash against the guy who's more of like a track football guy, and the bodybuilder like has a bilateral hamstring pull because he can't coordinate those muscles, right? And I think that's a huge part of it is, you know, you have to be able to run and sprint and sequence, you know, firing of those muscles, even that third calf, and figure out how to turn things on and off very quickly, right? So does the weight room do that? Not in the same way. So I get into these debates with people a lot about, okay, well, what is the purpose of weightlifting and speed training?
Yeah.
And I think it's a general strength quality that transfers over to your speed training. So
yeah, let's stick on that. Can we get a few insights in terms of how you actually program your athletes in terms of how many times you let them lift compared to how many times you want them on the track?
Yeah, I mean, when I initially started, I would do a typical kind of high-low program, like a Charlie Francis program, where you would sprint first and lift after, and you do that 3 times per week. Mm. And so maybe it's Monday, Wednesday, Friday, you're sprinting and lifting, maybe some plyos, so all your high-intensity elements on those days. And then on the Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, we do more, you know, conditioning runs, tempo runs, med ball circuits, strength circuits, low-intensity stuff.
Yeah.
So that's how I started out. And I found that had its limitations because I was trying to load on too much stuff on those high days sometimes. So, oh, we got to get a great lift. Oh, we got to get a great, you know, sprint volume. And we got to get some jumps in. And as you went through the week, I found that, you know, by the time you got to the end of the week, people were pretty depleted. So then I started to, like, one thing that Charlie said was when we got into a taper period, he said if the volume is lower in a taper period, now we can do high-intensity elements on every day because their effect or the impact on the athlete wouldn't be as profound. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then ultimately that athlete would end up running faster. So I'm like, well, why can't I do that for most of the year? So I started to switch to maybe if I did, you know, 450 to 500 meters of total sprinting on that high day, now I'm squeezing it down to like, you know, maybe 300, 280, 300. And I'm trying to do a little bit on every day, maybe starts one day, maybe some other things another day, and spread everything more, but just drop the volume by about 50%. Yep. So that, and that's, yeah, I even found that, like, when I went high, low, when I went to the low, you're like, oh, this is good, I get almost to recover, but getting back up to that high again was tough the next day, like, even just psychologically. So by hitting somebody and microdosing somebody every day with a little bit of speed, there are some drills that are speed-related, maybe some strength training, some conditioning, and I always finish the day with some tempo running. I've had some pretty good success. So I have to say right now, I'm at a bit of a crossroads as to how to organize my week or my microcycle in the best possible way. And I'm not saying you go hard every day. I'm just saying you have a bit of intensity every day and balance it off with maybe some general, you know, qualities like endurance for recovery. Maybe general strength, body weight circuits, med ball circuits, maybe like, you know, stuff with lighter weights. And
yeah.
I don't know.
Do you think we spend too much time on an activity? Like, I remember back in the day when we played kids sports, You know, we used to have like this thing that if we spent 2 hours in the room, it was mad. But I'm getting more and more as I get older, I'm feeling better the less kind of that I do. How's that kind of?
You're talking like 2 hours training?
Yeah, 2 hours training. Sometimes we're out there and we just because we're sweating so hard, we think it's doing us some benefits. Yeah. Have you found any of this kind of going shorter? Is it better?
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, like, I speak to NFL teams about this, and you know, training camp. Oh, we got to have now. You know, some of these colleges are going. You can't do two a day, so you're doing just one long practice. Mm. If you do one long workout, what are the chances you're going to have a lot of intensity in that 2 hour or 3 hour period? So if you have a 3 hour practice. And you tell the players, hey, we're going to practice this for 3 hours. Are they going to be like, yeah, let's just hit it, you know, hard at the beginning? They're going to be like, I got a 3 hour practice. Like, I'm going to take it easy here and easy here. And they're going to pace themselves.
Yeah.
But if you cut that practice to 45 minutes and say, we're going to get after it, it's a lot easier for them to conceptualize that. Okay, let's go. And then we're going to be rewarded by putting out high intensity. And then we won't have to go as long. And so, and I think that's part of the problem now. With these injuries in the NFL, so you have ACLs, you have tendon ruptures, hamstrings. And so you go from this situation where you're practicing 3 hours, going from this drill to that drill, and Johnny knows about like how football practice is organized. It's like insane.
Yeah. We used to do 3 days.
Yeah.
So, you know, how are you supposed to get up and hit maximum speed and maximum acceleration and power and all these qualities that you need? Because guess what? You do all that for practice, and then the game comes. And then, you know, you have a couple of series or a couple of plays, and you have a series, and then you're on sidelines waiting while the defense is on, and then you hit the field again, and then you load up again. So the intensity of the game is different from practice. So if I have to be ready to run as fast as I can and then cut off of that, and practice is low speed because there is too much of it, I'm not ready. Like, I'm not ready for that velocity and that force application. I think that's what's happening now. You don't have people that are prepared for the intensity of the game.
You've kind of been my ACL tracker in the NFL this year, because I wanted to talk, like, Sherman, you know, blew his ACL out, and, you know, on your Facebook page, you'll put, like, the little clips on, and you know, another ACL tear. Do you think that this is more common because of that? Because the body, these athletes, they're so explosive. Because Sherman's, when he played, it looked like he was just cutting. You didn't see any thoracic twist when it happened, and then, you know, the whole thing ruptured. Is that an explosion thing in terms of, like, the power force transferring from a start-stop? Or what's your thesis on that?
I think it's a bunch. Obviously, there's a bunch of things going on, and we could talk about turf and shoes ad nauseum. I think that's part of it.
Yeah.
Okay. There was a game between Miami and I think it was the Raiders. And I'll send you this clip too. It was Marshawn Lynch. And in that field, it was a grass field. And that was one of the first games I've seen in a long time where somebody planted and he saw the ground shift. Like, it slipped a bit, and then he went. Another guy did it. He planted and it shifted, and you saw the grass come up, right?
Yeah.
You don't see that very often anymore. You know, I was in Kansas City, watched a game, and then I went down into the field. And it's a grass field, but it was perfectly intact. And I'm like, really? Like, you have, like, 350-pound guys pushing on each other, and the field is pretty good? Mm-hmm. So I think that interaction between the shoes and the turf is probably the first thing to look at. Mm-hmm. The other is, obviously, the training. I met with Jerry Palmieri, who was the strength coach for the Giants. And he went, and he said, this is what I did for training. Before the collective bargaining agreement, the recent one, it was like 12 to 14 weeks of like comprehensive training. And now this is what happened after, which is now 5 weeks. So you go from like 14 weeks to 5 weeks. Guys aren't really training that much, honestly. And then, you know, then the wear and tear issue. I think with Sherman, he was complaining of like, oh, you know, I knew it was a problem. And maybe there was some fraying, maybe there was some degradation there. And then it didn't take much, you know, once, you know, it actually happened. All these things, you know, stacked on top of each other. So, you know, there's a lot of things going on right now that are contributing to the injury. And I think the first one is probably the preparation side because of that change, right? And I don't think they're renewing that collective bargaining agreement for another couple of years. So who knows what's going to going to happen. Like every week, like this weekend, I'm going to be watching. But okay, who's going down now? Right? Yeah. With the big names that are going down. So it's unfortunate, but I think it's the NFL. If they really want to deal with it, they're going to have to look at, you know, how much they are requiring the players to prepare. You know, I mean, football is rough, right? You go through an entire season. The last thing you want to do is start training again. And I think a lot of these guys go, man, that was a long season. I'm going to take it easy for a while. Yeah. Do my 5 weeks. Some guys don't even go to the 5 week. They can not go and they won't get their bonus, right? Their workout bonus. They just do their own thing. And then there's a lot of private sector trainers that they're working with who just want to entertain them and make sure they feel good, right? Mm. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but, you know, there has to be some level of intensity in their training that's going to match what's going to happen in the game, right? And I just think that.
What's up, guys? Be sure to pick up your free copy of Conversations with Champions. This is our free ebook, which is comprised of inspirational quotes from past guests that we've had on the show.
Get inspirational quotes from champions such as Evander Holyfield, Jonathan Thurston, Grant Cardone, Gary Vee, Larry Holmes, Mario Andretti, Anthony Mundine, Joe DeFranco, and many, many more.
To pick up your free copy now, just simply go to our website, www.divisionboardpodcast.com/ebook. Put your name and email in the slot. It takes about 10 seconds, and we'll send you the book directly to your inbox. Now back to the show.
Yeah. So Derek, have you seen any accurate research in terms of figuring out what age we start to like lose our speed at all?
They always say speed's the first thing to go.
I was like 26.
I never got the speed though. I was like, how could that be the first thing to go?
You know, it seems like the natural progression is probably you're going to get to your late 20s, and then, you know, but you guys might have found this too. I found my strength went up in my 30s.
Yeah. Big time.
So, you know, maybe that's a compensation for your lack of speed development. And I would like to say it's because maybe we're not doing as much speed and it's just a natural detraining, but I think there's obviously things happening with the tendons.
What about testosterone? How much does that play part?
Oh, I'm sure that's huge as well. Yeah. You know, and so it gets a little interesting when you see some of these guys who are, you know, kind of bucking the trend and still winning medals, running fast later in life, and you know, are they freaks? Are they supplementing with something? You know, and that's the tough part about track and field is that, you know, like weightlifting, people are still doing amazing things. But, you know, historically, it's been pretty rife with performance-enhancing drugs. And I'm not going to say people are still using them ad nauseum, but, you know, after that Russia thing, like, yeah, people Icarus. Are still using them. And, yeah,
did you watch Icarus?
Yeah. And you're like, oh, geez. Yeah, they got a little trap door and they're handing like a new urine sample to people.
Crazy.
You're like,
it was disheartening when I watched it coming from I'm a sports junkie, played ball my whole life, various sports. But yeah, we can talk about that film. I wanted to touch base though here. I don't want to call it a myth buster, but one of the guys that I follow is a popular strength and conditioning coach, and he works with a lot of MMA fighters. And I don't want to, I want to hear your opinion first. Maybe I'll give him a shout out after. But he's very vocal in terms of getting his fighters to get quicker and speed in the octagon of training uphill or running downhill rather than running uphill. And he always talks about, you know, the whole Rocky, when Rocky hit the scene, you started seeing people mimicking what they saw in that movie. And it kind of created this hive mentality of thinking that running up a hill is better for speed than running down a hill. And then he starts using things like our body's muscle lengthening and shortening cycle. When we're running downhill, forces us to trigger on different muscles, which will then have a carryover when we're running linear, like with speed. Have you heard anything of that?
Yeah, you hear it a lot. Like they call it over speed, right? So, you know, run downhill, have something tow you, like get dragged by in a car, whatever. Because
Walter Payton used to sprint uphills. He was one of my
favorites. Yeah, and Jerry Rice too, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, and I think it was interesting. I was talking to strength coach Al Miller, who's been in the league for 25 plus years, and I was asking about Jerry Rice, and he was saying that maybe the thing that made him special wasn't his, like, top speed compared to everybody else, but his ability to reproduce it throughout the entire game. And so, you know, maybe first, second quarter, you know, if things were pretty even, but as the other guy, the defensive back, got tired, he just always kept running at the guy as hard as he could, and he could maintain that. So maybe that's where the hill helped in terms of his, you know, his kind of speed endurance, for lack of a better word. So he could just keep reproducing that level of speed based on his conditioning. And so there's something to be said for that. And maybe the same, you know, with Walter Payton. When you run uphill, it's predominantly going to be an acceleration-based mechanics, right? So running uphill is like, you know, the same as you would accelerate out. It just extends it, just like some of the sled pulling they're doing now. So there's value in those things. The downhill running and the overspeed gets a little precarious because if you've ever like run downhill, you know, like I always said, like you know that thing they do in Gloucester where they roll the cheese down and everybody sprints after the cheese. Yeah, you see what happens there, right?
Yeah,
it's not good.
Torn up.
You know, yeah, because at some point you're going to overstride in front, brake, and then you're going to flip over and over rotate, right? So I think that's the danger. I know some people said, well, we do very, very gradual decline sprinting, which is like, okay, for the most part, anybody who runs fast in track and field isn't doing that technique. So that's why I kind of question it. If the fastest people are using it, there must be a reason behind it. And like I said, Charlie Francis is always about, you don't want, you know, you, the tendency when you go downhill and you pick up speed is for you to step further up in front of your body to prevent you from, you know, getting into a risky situation. So you end up, you end up teaching people to actually brake.
Yeah.
You know, so that would be my biggest concern. I assume in the MMA context, it's not gonna hurt them unless they fall down. But I can't see it hurting them in terms of their running mechanics because the cage is just so big. Like they're not. I mean, what they're gonna accelerate? What, two strides and then like do a flying Superman or knee somebody in the head? So you know, running is not that critical in MMA, but so maybe that's not hurting them. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, like, I would just be very careful as a coach because, you know, bad things can happen if they pick up speed, they're planting too far ahead of their center of mass, and just the impact, like just the repetitive impact of doing that would be a concern for me. Or if, you know, if you're running down a grass hill and somebody slips, you know, I think it's been proven that there's better ways to get fast than resorting to that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Derek, do you use the sled much in terms of, because I know Joe DeFranco is a big advocate for using heavy sled sprints to improve the times of his NFL guys. Have you seen something similar?
Yeah, I mean, I messaged Dan Paff about that. I said, look, I kind of see where it's useful, but, you know, some of the heavy sled pushing and heavy sled pulling, I could see where it, could not be useful, and like he brought up exactly the same point that I was thinking is what happens when you use a heavy sled is you actually teach them to be on the ground longer, right? Because that's what's going to happen. You're going to be pushing on the ground longer and probably pushing backside more than you should be. So again, you know, when I use the sleds, I would be very careful about keeping the weight relatively light and using it to help set up their posture. So if you have any, you know, we use bands sometimes. But if you're tethered to a sled around the waist, it allows you to hold acceleration position longer and work on your technique.
Okay.
Now, does it have to be really heavy? Not necessarily. I think, you know, it's probably going to help. If you have a heavy sled, it's probably going to help you, I think, in the first 2 to 3 strides. And then elasticity is a much bigger part of it. So your first push-off blocks, you know, from Ralph Mann's research, it's probably maybe 3/4 of a second, that initial push. And then it quickly goes down to 0.2, 1/10, you know, 0.5, 0.1, 0.1 of a second, and you're on the ground for a pretty short time. So if you're training somebody to be on the ground, you know, I don't know how long it would be for a sled push, but I'm saying, you know, it could be as much as 0.5 seconds.
Yeah.
You're training the wrong system, in my opinion. You know, maybe good for a lineman in football, maybe a couple other sports, but, you know, I just think people see it and go, well, if pushing it for 5 yards is good, pushing it for 50 is probably better. But I think they're missing the point, at least from a speed perspective.
So. On your running mechanics website, you have that article, the Charlie Francis, the relevance and importance of speed reserve in sports. And you talk about maximal acceleration, submaximal speed, linear speed training. Now, is there a sweet spot? I know earlier in the chat we mentioned people are afraid to sprint. You know, people are shying away from sprinting. Is there a sweet spot in distance of, you know, are we sprinting 20 yards versus 60 yards? Is there an overkill amount of distance when we're using speed to kind of supplement in our training?
I mean, when I first started working with some of the higher level teams, I thought, okay, you watch the game, how far are people running in the game? And you try to be really specific. You say, okay, well, this position, they may not sprint more than 5 to 10 yards. In the medium position, so running backs and linebackers, so maybe they'll get up to 15 or 20. And then if you're a receiver, 30 or 40, if you look at the stats. And then, so I went with that, and it worked. It worked. So if I get out, you know, a bigger guy to run out further, or even a skilled guy to run out to 60, and they get to a higher velocity, what is the, not the consequence, but what is the benefit of that? The benefit is going to be, we know from the research that the faster you run, the more force you put into the ground, right? And the more you develop that neurological capability to be elastic on the ground. So is there a systemic benefit from having that stress developed? And I think there is. I think if you could be more elastic, and you can fire quicker, then everything, you know, it's like one of those things where if you're I don't play video games, but I'm sure if you play and it's just really fast, you know, the good guys can slow things down and they can see things better. And I think it's kind of like that with speed. If I can go faster, then when I play the game and I'm going slower, everything is easier. So, you know, that's why now I'm tending to push people a little farther than I used to and get them up to where their top speed is. And sometimes that's as simple as, you know, setting up timing lights and figuring out where their max speed is reached and then going, okay, let's work on that. Let's try to get you a little higher in your max velocity and then get you to accelerate a little longer. So I think there's a benefit. Do people need to run like 150 or 200 meters to prepare for team sports? No, I don't think so. Like the dude from South Africa, the 400-meter guy, fast guy. He can run 110 seconds. He can run a 200 under 20 seconds. He can run a 443 seconds. But apparently he can't play touch rugby without blowing out his ACL. So, you know, so he's not prepared to play that sport because he's used to running long sprints. And, you know, so you want to make sure that you're getting the maximum benefit from a certain thing, but you're not so far off the deep end that it's not paying back in any way. So,
Hey Derek, speed of foot versus speed of hand. You know, Johnny brought up MMA before. Is there any actual way of improving hand speed?
There was a sprinter from Scotland, Alan Wells, 1980. He won the 100 meters at the Moscow Olympics when only half the world showed up, and he did a lot of fast bag training, and he said that he felt that contributed to his leg speed. So maybe there's an argument that the reverse could be true, that if you increase your leg speed, you know, there could be a feedback sort of mechanism that makes you move your hands faster, right? So, but the problem is that typically you can move your hands faster than your legs, because, you know, there's a shorter connection between your brain and your hand. They're lighter. So probably it's better, I would say, if you worked on hand speed and you wanted it to enhance some lower body qualities, I think there's a benefit there. As far as improving overall hand speed, you know, I don't know. That's not really my expertise. I do emphasize arms a lot as part of my sprint coaching.
Yep.
I think, you know, some people say it doesn't really do anything. You know, we can't prove that it does. I just have had better results by cueing people to focus on the speed and the rate of their arm swing to regulate the lower body. So I'm going to keep doing that, and, you know, maybe there'll be some science to support it. But with kids, that's the first thing I talk about, because you can see your hands. It's much more tangible. You don't want people looking down at their feet. So, you know, if I can get front side with my hands, it tends to help you get front side with your mechanics on your running. If you want to do some like you know, and I'm a big supporter of doing other sports and cross training. So maybe if you had kids work on hand speed, on hitting pads, or, you know, maybe it could transfer. I'm not going to say it doesn't, you know. So, but, you know, I think there's something there.
Excellent.
All right, we've run out of time, but we've got one final opportunity to ask a question. Have you got? Did you want to do it? Because I've got one.
Yeah, you could do it, because we'll just have to bring you back on, man, because the whole, like, technology side of things, I wanted to ask about wearables. But TK, for lack of time, you shoot the last one.
Yeah, it's just because Charlie Francis has been brought up a lot in this interview. So I was really intrigued at what age you actually met Charlie and what you found in Charlie that was just so influential.
Well, I think, you know, when I was young, and so I, you know, started really training probably late 70s, early 80s. And for anybody who was involved in track and field in Canada, the big influence was a fellow named Gerard Mock, who was from Poland, and he introduced, like, the marching and skipping drills, the mock drills. And so he was a mentor for Charlie. So a lot of the stuff that you saw from Charlie originated from Gerard Mock, and it trickled down to a lot of the youth development programs. It was probably, you know, a really good time in terms of youth development and coaching in Canada, you know, the 70s into the 80s, because I think they sucked so bad at the 76 Olympics. And so people are like, oh, God, we suck. So they made a push from a coaching point of view, and it really trickled down. So I was exposed to a lot of this stuff before I even met the guy. So it was kind of an easy thought process to transfer to, because you're like, oh, okay, I remember we did that when I was a kid. At least now you have a better understanding of it. And so, you know, I competed as a track athlete, and even though Charlie was out of the sport, he was still around because his wife was still competing. She's a bit younger than him, quite a bit younger than him, so he would be at track meets, and he could go up and talk to him. And that was kind of cool. And, you know, I think, you know, the general public thought, oh, this guy just did it with steroids. They didn't really understand that everybody was doing steroids at the time, and he was just a very good coach, a very smart guy. So I think people within the sport knew that, and just, you know, when you ask them a question, he'd give you a pretty straightforward answer, and it was very simple. He didn't try to overcomplicate things. And then when I got to about, you know, 2000, 2001, I went to a seminar that he was giving. It was in Los Angeles, or just north of Los Angeles. There were, like, maybe 10 people there, and it was really good. He went, I still have that on video. I should send that to you guys.
Yeah.
And he went through everything. Like, for 2 days straight, you're just like, oh, geez, this guy's way ahead of the curve. And from there, kind of maintained contact with him, went out to Toronto, started doing some work with him on developing his material and learning from him. And then I had about 10 years with him, where I was just, you know, able to talk to him at any given time, hang out with him, work with some athletes. And I think the best thing he could have done was set up a philosophy or a way to think about training for me that allows you to look at other things and go, okay, I can make sense of that. It wasn't like, hey, here's my program, go do it. It was, okay, think about this. Have you considered this? So it was more conceptual, and I think that's the best way to learn. He was never tied to one exercise or one way of doing things. And I think it just gave me an open mind about everything. And that's the best thing I could, you know, offer any younger coach is, you know, have a philosophy that allows you to grow as a coach. And I think that's the best thing he passed on. And when I'll send you guys some of the video, and you can go through it. And just the way he taught stuff, you're like, well, that makes so much sense. Like, how come I didn't think of that before? And I think, you know, you guys have been in the industry for a while. A lot of people out there want to make it complicated and want to make it, you know, like it's their own brand and they come up with something special. It's like, no, this is all pretty simple.
Yeah. So, it reminds me of
that's what I go. Go ahead.
It reminds me of a quote. Like, have you heard, I think it's a broad understanding of one thing, you'll see it in everything.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. Yeah. It's cool.
Yeah. And you know, the funny thing is I think he had a degree from Stanford University in history. And I'm like, okay, that makes sense. Like, because he had a very broad perspective on things. And coincidentally, like, my undergrad was in political science and history. And so at first I was, like, embarrassed by that. Like, oh, I'm in sports and I have a, like, arts degree in political science and history. And I'm like, no, this dude was on to something.
Yeah,
so,
it's important.
Yeah. So, and that's what I tell coaches. Like, somebody's like, oh, what's the best school to go to? I don't know. Just talk to people. Like, find people, talk to them. Yeah, go to school. You know, have fun, drink beer, whatever. But, you know, your learning is going to take place by doing something and then talking to people going, hey, I did this. What did you do? Yeah. Well, I did this, and this worked, right? And just exactly what we're doing right now.
Yeah.
That's the best way. So, you know, that's what I'm trying to do with, you know, some of the stuff that I'm doing with my websites. Like, I have a new one called sprintcoach.com.
Yeah,
and I just want it to be like, yeah, I just want it to be a teaching site, like, where people can, we can get online and a bunch of us can talk about stuff and share ideas. And, you know, and even in New York, that's what I'm doing here. Most of the time I'm just trying to meet with people and just kind of say, hey, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Okay, that's cool. So, yeah, you guys are doing the right thing, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Appreciate that. Well, before we let you leave, just all your contact details online, your www.strengthpowerspeed.com. You mentioned the other one, which was on yesterday, and I actually think as good as Strength Power Speed is, the sprintcoach.com, that's the place to go. I really enjoyed actually going on your site yesterday. So much information on there, man.
And I'm not like a website expert, so I got a guy helping me out. And so we're just going, okay, how are we going to present stuff? And I just want to, again, I want to, like Johnny said, like, let's get people to think, right? Let's not get people just to go, okay, this is exactly what I got to do, because it's not like that. Like, you know, hey, it's raining out. Were you going to do the same workout? Well, shit, no, it's raining. And, you know, think
right.
laterally, man. Like, for sure. that's the best thing you could give somebody is this ability to kind of work outside the box. So that's what I'm hoping it becomes. Who knows? Maybe I'll just sell out and I'll just sell shitty programs and try to make money.
But, do a photo shoot, have your shirt off.
Four-week program.
Yeah. There's spots filling up.
Bicep curls for speed, yeah.
For sure.
All right. Also, Twitter, you're at Derek M. Hansen as well. That's your main one that you use for social media, right, Derek?
Yep. And then, you know, I'm by no means an expert. You guys seem to have a better handle on that stuff than me. So I'll just kind of watch you guys go, hey, shit, that was a good idea. So,
yeah.
Social media.
So,
yeah.
I'm afraid to do the live things that you guys do.
Come on, Derek.
You know what? Forget something to say or...
So, yeah, that was funny. That was given to me from a business coach of mine. Like, 8 months ago, I was getting ready to chat with, like, a big mentor of mine. And he's, like, he's a very famous physicist. And I was so nervous. And so my business coach said, if you're nervous, just do Facebook Lives. Go to the busiest part of Sydney during rush hour and just press record or just press play, because you're going to be forced to evolve in that specific moment. Ad-libbing sort of thing, and I started doing that, and it actually helped. So anybody listening, I use Facebook Live as a developmental tool, one, to get my message across, but also, two, to develop just certain skills on, you know, just thinking on the spot. So I think it's useful.
Yeah,
that's smart, man. Like, when you're in the food court, I'm just, like, glued to it. I'm like, dang, I need me some ramen noodles now.
How dare you.
That's a good food court, too.
Derek, man, I'm glad we finally got to do this. Keep doing what you're doing. We really appreciate you sharing space with us on the Vision Board, man, so thank you.
Hey, anytime you guys want to call me up and you want to just talk about something, I'm all for it.
We'll do a Facebook
Live.
That's
awesome, man. Yep. Thanks a lot, guys.
Johnny, Derek Hansen, man.
Yeah, he's a guy that I've been following online for a few years now. One of my coaching mentors has been in my ear for the last couple months. Johnny, reach out to him. The funny thing is, when I went to reach out to him on social media, we were already friends. So it's kind of like that small network of no matter how big the world is, if you're in like the strength scene, if you're a coach, it's not that big. You have the power at your fingertips to reach out to people, and we're stoked to have done that with Derek, because he's been in the game for... He's like a vampire.
He's so young, though. I didn't want to ask him the question, how old are you? Because I go, you've been in here since 1988, so I was 6 when you started.
Me too.
But you know, he looked probably 6 years older than me.
Yeah, and guys, we did this interview via video, but, you know, we stream it just audio. I was thinking that the whole time. I was like, dude, this guy's a vampire. He looks... the years weren't adding up.
Yeah, maybe I'm 35, so I was thinking he was 41.
Yeah, 41 tops, but he's
realistically late 40s. He's got to be, if he started at 18, he's got to be 12 years older than us, so he must be 47.
47 at the youngest. Yeah, that's nuts. So that's an attribute.
Well, Derek, I know Derek, you'll be listening, so
You look young, young man.
Yeah, man. Well, we only get so much time to talk with these guests, and you know what we covered. It was kind of like, you know, I didn't want to. When we get experts like this, I think it's important to ask questions that our listeners could get benefits from. Yeah. With a guy like Derek, we could have, you know, we barely touched base on the recovery side of things.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big important part of output and performance. But to hear his, you know, talking a little bit about the myths I asked him. Mm. Did you never heard the extra calf muscle one?
Nah.
Damn, that might just be an Ohio thing.
I think people are bigger than Australian people, though.
Hold on. See, why didn't you bring this up then? What do you mean bigger?
Because, well, for
you
example,
you guys have Islanders.
You guys, no, but you guys seem to be ridiculously taller over there. I remember, like, for example, if I buy a basketball jersey over there, I'm like an extra large in kids. A small in adults is still pretty long on me.
Yeah.
And I know I'm not overly huge, but when you see some of the guys over there are some big guys. And obviously, natural sports to you guys over there are things like basketball.
Yeah.
And that means that you guys have got guys that the point guards, like for example, someone that's a point guard between 6 foot and 6'3", is considered really, really tall in Australia.
Yeah, not anymore in America.
They seem to have massive guards.
I remember when that started shifting, that specific position. I think it was like 1994 or 5. I was 12 or 13, and at the time in the NBA, the point guards were like guys I grew up watching: Mark Price, who was 6 foot; John Stockton, who was 6'2". But then you had like Magic Johnson, who was 6'7". Penny Hardaway, who was 6'7", and then that's when it was like, oh, there's a shift here. You could be 30 years earlier, 6'7", were centers. So I wonder if there has been studies or research with the correlation of progression of sports in a culture with the idea that the people were growing into the sport, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because what else would make sense? Because think about George Mikan, the NBA's first big man. Guys, Google him, old black and white days of the 50s. Mm. George Mikan was only, I think, 6'7", 6'6". You put him, he's a guard now. When you got guys like Shaq and Hakeem who are 7-footers, only 40 years later, I wonder how much of that has to do with just being entwined in the culture and then also us adapting to that culturally and then growing into that sport.
Big time. Have you been watching the 76ers play?
Uh-oh. Ben Simmons, Embiid, you got some Aussie talent there, right?
Embiid's
a savage.
Oh my god!
Yeah,
and you're mixing with. Have you seen Ben Simmons' stats?
Ridiculous. He's a stat.
I thought LeBron for mine is the greatest player since Michael Jordan.
Well, how do you measure greatness? You know, some people say Jordan was a winner. LBJ's lost some championships.
And he hasn't won with it. Yeah, I get what you're saying.
But then from a stats point, LeBron does things on the stats that Michael could only dream of.
That's what I mean, because
he can pass, and he can play
power forward, and he can play more positions.
He rebounds, he passes. So he's a triple-double sort of guy.
Yeah, so triple-double sort of guy, and that's coming from a big Cavs fan.
Yeah.
But LeBron took 130 games to hit 2 triple-doubles.
Simmons in 10. Yeah, it was crazy. Well, you got Zoe. I've really been detached from the all pro sports lately, but the kid ball.
He didn't play point in college.
LeBron?
No.
Oh, Simmons. Did he go to? He went 1 year at LSU,
yeah,
right?
LSU.
And he's a Melbourne kid?
He is. His dad is actually American.
Okay.
Dave Simmons, but he played in the NBL here.
Yeah.
And he's like a bit of a gangster, sort of really high profile guy who played in the Australian League.
Yeah.
So it's no surprise to see him have the genetics to actually make it into the
NBA. When you guys use the word gangster, that's like a term of endearment.
Yeah,
like,
very.
He's like
I'm
a
saying,
G.
He's,
yeah,
he's
a stud.
He's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So with the Simmons, so young, filling the stats, are you predicting future star? Are you predicting future Hall of Famer?
Depending on injury.
What do you see? He's already had 1 year he lost because that hurt that injury.
I'm predicting
Hall of Famer?
Hall of Famer.
Wow. You know what? I read an article about that, and because of his amazingly start to the second season, because he lost his first season due to injury, there's writers now, experts, talking about maybe it's a good thing for these kids right out of college to take a year off.
Sit on the bench.
Did you see that? To sit on the bench, to heal their bodies, get used to the speed of the sport, get used to the
watch more, right?
Yeah, watch in college as well. You know, at the most, if you make it to the Final Four, if you make it to the tournament, you're going to play 30 to 35 games. That's it.
Yeah.
The NBA is an 82 game season. That is a long, long season. They're playing back to back. They're doing West Coast swings, East Coast swings. A lot of 19, 20 year olds, they're not accustomed to be able to deal with that travel. They're not accustomed. They don't have the wherewithal to recover.
Yeah.
So maybe having that first year as like a mentoring year, it would probably, their theory with the article using Simmons as an example was that maybe you would have less injuries happening to these young guys transitioning from the college to the pro game.
It's going to be interesting. I think Australia's got a good chance of winning a silver or bronze medal.
You know what? I don't want to argue on that. Olympic you got some ball. That's why, if you get Simmons to play, that? You have to get those guys. Is Embiid going to play?
No, but he's not Australian.
He's not? Why do I? Joel?
No, he's American.
Is he?
Yeah.
He wasn't an Aussie.
No. So when I was looking at the team, so there's eight Australian players in the NBA right now. So the next Olympics.
Look how stoked you are.
Bogut and Dellavedova will probably be starting from the bench because we've got Aaron Baines starts at Celtics.
Patty Mills?
Thon Maker.
Okay, that's the kid. I was mixing up Thon Maker and Embiid.
He plays at the Bucks. Okay. You've got Joe Ingles, who starts at Jazz. You've got Patty Mills, who plays a lot of minutes and sometimes starts at the Spurs.
Yeah.
And then you have the point guard, who will be Ben Simmons.
Has championship.
We'll never match the Americans because you just got pure depth. You know what I mean? You could list 200 players that could play in the Olympics.
No, you're right.
But in terms of the next step down and trying to challenge for either a bronze or silver, I'll be disappointed if they don't win a medal.
Honest with you, man, last year Olympics, I know Australia didn't do as well as they wanted to do. You know, we were interviewing Luke Longley, and he was highlighting the fact that you know the way the Aussies play basketball, I enjoy. They play a team version.
We play 80s version.
You know what it reminds me of, though? It reminds me of like Duke basketball.
Reminds
you
guys play Knicks versus Bulls.
You guys play like Coach K. It's almost like you have Coach Krzyzewski coaching you guys. Not one guy is required to carry all the weight, but if each guy isn't carrying their individual weight, they're going to get him out of there. You know, I think that's the danger sometimes with teams like America, and then, you know, when Spain was on top, is that Argentina, France with Parker. You have these countries who are notoriously good, but a lot of the weight maybe are just on one or two guys.
Yeah, I think Argentina and Spain, they adapted to the rules better than the Americans did.
Cause they sped it up.
International rules whole game. Are so much different. So.
Do you think that has to do because they're good at soccer? Because I see the way they play NBA.
Yeah, they're probably better at playing tempo.
Tempo, and they brought a different speed to the game. In the mid-2000s, I remember when Tony Parker first came over, Manu Ginobili first came over, and you had Dirk coming out of Germany. And you just saw the NBA taken to a different level because they started playing at a different pace. And it also changed the dynamic of the five spot. What was a traditional center position in the 80s and 90s with your Shaquille O'Neals, Hakeem Olajuwons, David Robinsons, you started seeing that five position when Dirk came on board totally different. You never saw a seven-footer hit threes. You never saw a seven-footer bring the ball up. So that European impact, and I wonder if it could kind of relate to soccer. It's
now in terms of culturally. You know, when we grew up, like when you say 90, well, 80, say 88 to 95, there was literally no international players in the league.
And there weren't a lot.
And then three or four per team.
Per team. Oh, do you have a team like... there's a team I just saw. They're all international. Is it Dallas or is it San Antonio?
Potentially.
There's teams that are now all international, which I think is a great, obviously amazing for the sport of basketball.
But as an American, would you still support them as hard if you don't have Americans in the team?
Oh, it doesn't matter to me what country you're born in when it comes to cheering for my team.
They haven't really gone into the international
world. I'm a Cleveland Cavs fan. Diehard.
Was it just winning that match? I've been a difference.
Because we lost for so long. I've been a Cavs fan since Mark Price, Brad Doherty, Larry Nance, Hot Rod Williams. We had Steve Kerr at one time. We had Craig Elo at one time. So no matter, I don't have any differentiation of where a guy's born at in terms of who I'm cheering for. I'm cheering for that team and that city. Yeah, it's kind of diehard.
Tristan Thompson having a kid with Khloe Kardashian.
Tristan, I hope he needs. I don't even want to bring that up because we're not really playing too well yet. Because I feel it's the curse of the Kardashians.
Well, I still haven't got your point in yet.
Isaiah, that trade, and Boston's killing them. Boston's first in the East,
and they haven't even had a Hayward playing.
Yeah, so it's going to be interesting. It's good to see the parity now in the Eastern Conference. It once was just the Cavs and everyone else. Now it's like LeBron, Philly, Boston. There's so many other teams.
East. It's good to see the East picking up because the West is always going to be strong. We think Golden State's from there.
For sure.
Oklahoma looks great.
Yeah.
On paper, anyway.
Dude, the NBA is in a good place right now. There's so much good young talent. The speed of the game is changing. It's getting more visceral. I like what Derek brought up. And in the first part of the interview when he was talking about the NFL Combine and how the executives are looking for how they present the players, like how are they interviewing. You could see that.
Yeah.
You could see what once was
off the field so important.
It's so important to where they're not going to take a big risk on a kid now if they're not, but it goes to the college system with good college systems developing their young men. That's why guys like Coach K are important to develop these guys into NBA business because they're businessmen.
Yeah, it's a business now. So it's like they talk about family values. They even look at the way you dress, the way you cut your hair, everything.
Yeah, for sure. Social media is a big thing.
Yeah, these guys are running billion-dollar businesses. Yeah. So there's no doubt to see that going down that track. All right, Johnny, great episode. Before we go, man, next week we're going to have a special beret. Special Forces Green Beret, Andrew Martin on the show. So that's going to be a very important one. Something we recorded it this morning. We'll bring it to you next week, but it's one of those things that is something fresh from myself and Johnny. We've never, even though we've had Tim on the show, Tim Kennedy, this is going down a deeper path. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The insights we got from Andrew were just unbelievable.
We're going to talk about concussions, brain activity, getting in depth about, you know, the issues that are facing a lot of people, which aren't being spoken about in the mainstream. So we're stoked to highlight that interview for you guys.
Definitely. Johnny, before we go, social media.
Guys, follow me, Johnny Stofko. All socials, hit me up.
Yeah, definitely. Get in touch with Johnny. I'm at Tristan Cannell across all my channels. So please hit us up. Tag us any posts with your family and friends. Best way for us to grow is if you tell your family and friends. So please do.
Tell all your friends. Come on, guys. Peace.
All right, Johnny. TK. We'll check you next week, brother.
I'll see you soon, big dog.
Peace.
Welcome to the Vision Board Podcast. Stories of success from around the world.
You guys are scratching an itch, and that's why this podcast has become popular and successful, is because you guys are scratching an itch. You're enjoying it, and you're also benefiting from the knowledge that people are dropping.
I've never met the person in my life, including my parents, that was able to outwill me about me.
Whatever profession you're in, you need to keep working harder. You know, nothing comes easy these days, and you know, you'll get knocked down, but get back up, that counts, so just keep working hard at it.
You know, you guys said you do stuff, you ask things that aren't Googleable. You guys are two for two.
There's never been a time in my life where anybody ever was able to tell me who I was more than I knew who I was.
To join our vision and follow the journey, please subscribe to the Vision Board Podcast via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher.